From Pacifica Radio, KPFT 90.1 Houston, this is Open Journal in Exile. Open Journal is the Houston community magazine of the airwaves. Join us as Duane Bradley and Stephanie Coleman explore the wonder that is the Petro Metro and the people who make it happen. And now from our temporary, socially distanced, alternative studios in exile, somewhere in the greater Houston area, this is Open Journal in Exile. Let the conversation begin.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Duane Bradley.
And I'm Stephanie Coleman.
And as many of us are trying to understand the difference between allergies and flu symptoms, or to determine if we're asymptomatic super spreaders for COVID-19, it seemed like this would be a really great opportunity to get some facts. So we here at Open Journal thought it might be timely to have a little sit down with subject matter experts that have a background in public health to talk through some of what we're all dealing with right now. Hopefully, we might gain some insights, perhaps obtain some access to information, some tools to help us during these trying times as we head into indoor weather and the winter months here, short though they may be in the Houston area. Recognized as a global innovator and trusted agency, the Houston Health Department has established equitable, data-driven, sustainable public health practices for the city of Houston. Central to its success is public trust, as well as timely implementation of relevant and progressive methods for mitigating crisis.
Marlene McNeese is an internationally celebrated leader in public health, who currently serves as the Assistant Director of Disease Prevention and Control Division of the Houston Health Department. In this role, she oversees surveillance and epidemiology of infectious and communicable diseases, the City of Houston's Laboratory Service, Tuberculosis Control, Public Health Preparedness, and HIV, STD, and Viral Hepatitis Prevention. McNeese's extensive leadership experience and knowledge of behavioral and public health has made her a valuable asset locally and nationally. In addition, Decretia Limbrick is a graduate of Texas Women's University and Texas A&M University, College Station. She has served in public health for 20 years and is currently the Assistant Director for the Houston Health Department. The programs for which she is directly oversight are immunizations, Nurse Family Partnership, Healthy Families, and WIC. In 2013, Decretia successfully completed the National Urban Fellows American Leaders of Change program, and she is currently responsible for the oversight of more than 200 employees. Since January 2020, Marlene and Decretia have been instrumental in leading the public health response to the current COVID-19 pandemic. Their efforts to maximize public health outreach and impact spans a wide range of programs and initiatives, including residential, schools, businesses, and a myriad of collaborators and various partners and stakeholders. Marlene and Decretia, thank you so much for joining us, and welcome to Open Journal.
Thank you for having us.
Glad to have you.
Thank you both for joining us. So what exactly is the Houston Health Department and its role in daily lives of the citizens of Houston?
So I would say, and I know my colleague may have more to add, but you know, we are, and we see ourselves, our rallying cry internally is that we protect the aged. So we serve in, you know, traditional public health roles and functions in offering access and serving as catalysts for Houstonians to get necessary services that they may need to protect their health or to achieve better health outcomes. And in many cases, we also serve as a safety net provider of health services where other Houstonians may not be able to access them. So we both serve to protect, but we also provide services as well. And we've been doing that for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm. So much like the Houston Police Department, to protect and serve, or serve and protect in a different way.
Yeah, and it's great that you say that, because we certainly have owned our role as first responders and emergency responders, just like the police department, just like the fire department, in being essential to the operation of the city and protecting our residents.
And I would just add to that, Marlene, and say, much like you were saying, in terms of the Houston Police Department, not all first responders have sirens. So some first responders do show up in blue polos. And so we're those first responders that often show up in blue polos. So yeah.
It's amazing because no one knows the value of public health until they really need public health. Very invisible angels for the city on a lot of levels.
Definitely the secret guardians.
That's excellent.
Well, as we strive to navigate our way through this pandemic as a city, as a society, what is public health and its role?
Mm-hmm. And I think responding to this particular pandemic, we see our role as serving as most of our goals for public health in terms of delivering essential services, monitoring diseases and being able to rapidly respond to them, certainly being able to educate the public about what these diseases and the impacts of those diseases may mean to them. Again, I mentioned earlier, in especially in decreases areas where we are also the safety net actual provider of some services. So I'm sure we'll get into that in this conversation about how we actually deliver health services. And in and around COVID, there's a lot of work that we have done throughout 2020 to do that. And so I just believe that in these times, and maybe for the first time in America, we go through these cycles where we really understand the value and the role of public health. And in crises of pandemics and disease outbreaks, it becomes really, really clear the experts and the expertise that's required to have a real response and to save lives and to prevent the spread of these infections really is determined by the core work that public health departments do across the country. Conversely, we are often, because we're invisible, so this may be a con for the work that we do, many people sort of take their daily health and daily lives for granted, not understanding why your water is safe to drink is because of the role of the public health department. You know, why the air is acceptable for us to breathe and live and thrive, and it's because of the role of public health. And so for COVID specifically, we have been able to deliver these services quietly, but very intently and aggressively throughout to make sure, as bad as we see the numbers and cases are, we know that without these essential services that we are providing, it would be much worse. And so we are most collectively a passionate group of people who want to be experts in what we do and want to be able to provide these kinds of valuable essential services to the residents of Houston.
Well, as we look at that, and as residents, we hear so much, and we almost have information overload with what is right and what is wrong. And a basic question, what is the distinction between the coronavirus and COVID-19? And really, what's the language we should be using around that? Like, if we're going to sort of start at our core, like, what are we running from? And what's the part of this pandemic that makes public health so nervous, not just the media conversation around it?
Either one. I'll start. I can say, I think, and that's another part of what I think is our essential role, is making sure people have basic factual information. There is so much out in the media and through chatter and just, you know, conversational rumors with our families and friends that may, you know, get us off track and into the myth world a little bit. We really want to be the providers of factual information. And I find it most often just basic information about what we're describing as these diseases or infections. You know, basically there's differences between bacteria and viruses. I mean, oftentimes it's as simple as that. There's lots of distinctions between what makes SARS-CoV-2, and I don't want to get too deep in the nomenclature, but the actual virus itself is part of a series of viruses known as coronaviruses. And so the common cold being one example of a coronavirus. And I think the distinction is just being able to describe, you know, bacteria, we're accustomed to being able to get an antibiotic and be able to clear that right up. So most bacterial infections, it's as simple as that. But when it comes to viruses, the real approaches that we have in healthcare and medical care is really to either prevent people from acquiring viruses or to be able to effectively treat symptomology. And so that's the difference when we're talking about coronavirus. There's no antibiotic that's going to clear it right up, but we do have tools in the toolbox to help prevent you from acquiring it and to be able to treat it effectively if you were to be infected with it. So I would say that's important, and what we've tried to get really basic in our education information to the public is the differences between the two and why this is such a challenging virus to try to approach and tackle. It's new, so that makes it challenging in and of itself because we've had to spend some time figuring out how it operates so we can figure out an approach to address it and attack it. But I think most importantly, just folks understanding that we've got to prevent it. And if you are infected, we've got to figure out a way to provide some effective treatment for you.
Mm-hmm. So where does this data come from? Where do you gather this data? How much of this data do you create? And what is the conversation on a city and national way around public health data? What does that ecosystem look like?
So I could spend probably an hour in and of itself to describe where health data comes or originates from and how it's transferred and all of it. But to keep it simple, we really rely on lab tests for viruses and infections. So for COVID-19, there are many providers of those tests. So the results of those lab tests come to our department. As a public health department and departments across the country, we are essentially the reporting authority for most diseases and infections. And so those disease and lab results and case reports come to us from labs, hospitals, private providers, a number of places. And that's one way in which we gather data. But it's not just about knowing how many infections and or how many negatives that we have in terms of tests. We also collect data qualitatively. There's a lot of work that we do with assessing communities and talking about what they see as a health need. So that data does inform some of our programming and decision making as well. So that's what I would say as an overall view of data and how that gets collected. And again, most public health systems have been woefully underfunded and undersupported, under-resourced in our ability to collect data and to do it systematically and universally and efficiently. So I think for our response to COVID, what we've seen here and across the country is early on, I think we've made lots of strides to improve in this area, but we were getting lab results, and what's historically been the case, they've been faxed. They've been, oftentimes, mailed. So if we really want to respond rapidly, particularly if there are positive cases connected to those reports, we want to be able to respond quickly. And we all know that health outcomes greatly improve the faster we're able to address them. So the idea that many of our systems, both in public health, but even in private providers and other laboratories, that system of being able to manage the volume and to do it efficiently and quickly as it related to COVID-19 reports, we were just overwhelmed. And I believe everyone scrambled to try to figure out a way to make those systems operate better and to make those issues more efficient. And so I think over the last 8-9 months now, we certainly have made dramatic strides. As you remember, there was once upon a time about 14 days on average between you taking a test and being able to get your test result, which essentially didn't help us much in being able to intervene in the transmission, meaning you may have been positive and you may have been around others when you didn't know it, and our ability to tell you really you either had it or you didn't was hindered. And so that average of 14 days has dramatically been reduced, and I think we're down to 48 hours. And so I think that those kinds of systems, addressing how these systems operate, how we communicate, how the data gets transferred for there to be public health action, steps that we can take to actually help individuals and communities. It's taken some time. We were overwhelmed in the beginning, but I think we've gotten better.
You're tuned to Open Journal on Pacifica Radio, 90.1 FM here in the heart of Houston, Texas. We are visiting with Marlene McNeese and Decretia Limbrick from the Houston Health Department. I wanted to follow up on that question. You mentioned, you know, what's happened over these last few months and in the testing regimen in particular. I mean, we've been promoting across the board wearing masks, not as a political statement, but as a health statement, that I care enough about you to wear a mask, washing your hands so that you're not a carrier, so to speak, socially distancing so that I'm not going to cough on you or vice versa, and then getting tested, which is maybe the one that people out of the entire population of the city have probably done the least. And the different testing protocols, we've all seen those scary looking, you know, videos of the long Q-tip going up people's noses. We've seen that there's now like a cheek swab. There's like an antigen test with a pinprick and a blood sample. What's the relative effectiveness in terms of accurate testing results versus the maybe awkward experience of having a probe up your nose versus swabbing your cheek or a pinprick? Mm-hmm. You know, the pluses and minuses of those different testing methodologies and their general availability in the city of Houston.
I would say that, you know, this is an area too that is sometimes quite confusing for the general public. There are multiple types of test technologies. And so you mentioned the nasal swab and PCR testing being truly the gold standard when it relates to COVID-19 testing. And that's really looking at the DNA of the virus and whether or not that is present. And so that is what we would consider just our gold standard, being able to tell with the most accuracy whether or not there is presence or non-presence of SARS-CoV-19. But there are others. And as you mentioned, we've had a number of communities who describe the challenges with the way those types of samples are collected, and in some cases may be painful when it's too far up the nasal cavity and so on. But there are other technologies in operation now, and that's grown over time. Again, the more we've gotten savvy with how to respond, how to test, how to screen for COVID, we've gotten better as a country and certainly here locally. So antigen and antibody testing has also come on the market with several versions of FDA-approved tests. And so I think antigen screening being, I think, what we've seen and heard about the most in the news and what I think will be the most prolific as we move forward, meaning those results are able to be turned around in a very short window, mainly while folks might still be in a particular provider setting, having the test taken, you can get the results before you leave. And again, very accurate in terms of its output, in terms of a result, but it does have, depending upon on the actual test type, it may deliver a false negative. So for antigen tests, our only concern is to make sure that folks are using an appropriate testing algorithm and strategy about how to respond to that test result, because it may occur very, very, very rarely in circumstances where a person may indeed test negative, and that may not be accurate. So that's the only downside I would say about antigen testing. But the idea that most of them are rapidly delivered, most of them have an easier collection specimen process for the individual, I think we're just going to see more of them. And I think the test has become better over time. Mm-hmm. Decretia, I didn't know if you wanted to add anything else to the world of testing.
No, the only thing that I would definitely want to add, Marlene, is just that, much like you said, once we started out, the testing availability was limited. And so now as we have progressed and more supply has become available in terms of testing kits and individuals available to test and laboratories that are able to process specimens, that the testing is actually much more readily available. So again, making sure that individuals in Houston are utilizing all of the tools in the toolkit, and one being testing, knowing that that option is much more readily available. So
that's great. You know, you don't think about all of those variables that need to fall in line before you actually get in line for a test. That takes a lot to build up an infrastructure for this. And you both, have been recognized with the proclamation and a day named in your honor, because you, not only have you been a part of building this, you were there when there was no blueprint as to how to build it, let alone for a city as diverse and large and spread out in Houston. So how does that feel for your efforts to be recognized that way, and then to have a day of your own for your work around COVID?
The work that we do, for me, and I'm sure I can speak for Marlene, it's really a heart's work, and it's H-E-A-R-T. And in some instances, that work actually becomes hard work. But what I will say is that one of the great things about public health is that it is always a very rewarding work. And so to have the day, to have the proclamation was extremely great and extremely satisfying and extremely gratifying. But I think for me, even more gratifying is knowing that behind that work, it was a whole team of individuals that, so we got to be the face of the work and the reality that you all saw. But we realized that there was a huge amount of infrastructure and a huge amount of resources, human and tangible, that went into us just being able to be recognized in that way. Again, public health often, because of the success that we see, because we're able to eat in restaurants and not have to worry about the safety of the food, because we're able to swim when we want to, when it's not a pandemic, of course, and not have to worry about whether or not the pools are clean. Some of those things, because we have become accustomed to it being okay, we take those things for granted. So I think in public health, whenever we have the opportunity to be recognized for doing the great work that we do, it's always gratifying. So to have a day named in my honor is extremely great. Like when it launched, there was no blueprint. Actually, when we started the work, we didn't even have testing available. Mm-hmm. So really, at the core of public health, teaching those core public health principles. So we were really talking about, how do you teach one to avoid something for which we're still learning about? So again, those basic things, washing your hands, socially distancing. So before there was any test, we were trying to teach individuals what we already knew in public health, and that is prevent what's preventable. So, but again, it's gratifying and satisfying. So thank you.
Ditto.
So do y'all now have keys to the city?
If we have the key, we're not sure where the door is.
They won't tell us that part.
That is wonderful. You know, it is really wonderful, and it's really complicated, because public health and what you both have done historically, health department, is complex, as you've mentioned. And Marlene, with your experience with CDC and the National AIDS Council, as well as HIV and AIDS policy understanding for minority health, what are some of the things that you have learned through that process that might apply here? And do you know Dr. Fauci, and how does that work? Like, is that like a cluster of you guys who get together for lunch?
Yeah, I will say it's been, we don't get together for lunch. Let me clear that up. But I did have an opportunity to reflect with Dr. Fauci. Actually, I was privileged to be a part of an interview with him, and we go back for several decades with his work in vaccines trials specific for HIV. So he and U.S. Ambassador Deborah Birx, who also served on the White House advisory panel for COVID, you know, have spent many decades in HIV. And so because of that background and history, we worked together on a number of initiatives in the past. And I think for our current present day response to COVID-19, it's been remarkable to see how much the U.S. and I think even most public health departments around the country have picked up on the expertise from that movement. Not to say successful principles around that movement haven't been adopted in other public health programs in general, but for HIV specifically, the amount of work to engage community, to try to bridge those communication lines and foster trust and all of those things that are important to be seen as a trusted and valuable participant in their health. We certainly have used all of those principles in our local COVID response and making sure that we're transparent as we possibly can be about everything that we know. People really do want up-to-date, vital, factual information. So we've been very, very intentional about that from day day one and every day thereafter. We've also made sure that we go out to community. So as much as we want to be safe and protect ourselves and social distance, you know, we live in the South. People want to know that you care about them. You come to see about them. So we've done a lot of educational and door-to-door work in specific communities to say, you know, it may seem as though government and public health and these services are far off and unobtainable, inaccessible to you, but here we are. We're showing up at your door. We're showing up in your community. So I think those principles about how we've engaged in other public health programs in the past, those things that have worked, are the things that we have certainly intentionally brought to bear in this new COVID response.
Well, thank you. We will continue with far more of this conversation with Marlene McNeese and Decretia Limbrick from the Houston Health Department in just a couple of minutes. But it is time for the KPFT Open Journal Song of the Week. And this week it comes to us from local trio Krungbin featuring the amazing Leon Bridges on vocals. It's from an EP that was released in late 2019, just before everything kind of started shutting down. Texas Sun by Krungbin featuring Leon Bridges is Open Journal's Song of the Week.
Sun goes down. Texas sun. Say you wanna hit the highway while the engine roars. Well, come on, roll with me till the sun goes down. The Texas sun. Caressing you from Fort Worth to Amarillo. Well, come on, roll with me to the sun dips low. Texas sun. Texas sun. Oh, girl. Texas sun. When I'm far from home and the cold winds blow, stuck out somewhere to folks I don't. Cause you keep me nice and you keep me warm. Wanna feel you on me, can't wait to get back there again. Texas sun. Texas sun. Texas sun. You say you like the wind blowing through your hair. Well, come on, roll with me. The sun goes down. Texas sun. Texas sun.
Ooh, baby, you're so gorgeous. How about you and me? Take a little trip.
Take a ride with me, babe. You by my side.
outside. How does it sound? You and I, baby.
That was Texas Sun by Krungbin featuring Leon Bridges. Open Journal's Song of the Week. If you'd like to suggest a tune to be featured, just reach out to us on the socials or old school us. Open Journal at kpft.org. It is Monday, the 9th of November, 2020. You are tuned into the Mighty 90 KPFT Open Journal program. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for your support. I'm Duane Bradley.
And I'm Stephanie Coleman. We're very excited to continue our conversation with Marlene McNeese and Patricia Limbrick from the Houston Health Department, talking about all things public health and really giving us incredible insights into how public health works. We do want to ask, because there in our intro, we were sort of a little perplexed with how do you know if someone's sneezing because they have the flu or they have COVID, and what does that look like? And we are entering flu season. So, you know, maybe Decretia, you can even help us understand that, you know, COVID is not our only concern. And what are the similarities and differences between those two viruses? And what are your thoughts or some of the things that you're doing around public health and that impact?
Certainly. So you are correct. So we are continuing to deal with the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, as well as individuals in Houston starting to deal with their seasonal allergies. And then you add to that flu season. The only real way to know the difference, obviously, is to get the test to find out whether or not, you know, you're dealing with COVID-19 or if you're dealing with seasonal flu. But I guess some very basic things to know is that if you're dealing with some of the signs and symptoms that are more true to COVID-19 are things such as loss of smell, loss of taste, versus seasonal flu, where with flu you have more muscle ache, things along that line. And then with your traditional allergies, probably some nasal congestion, coughing, sneezing. But again, the thing that I would say is there's only one true way to know what you're really dealing with, because in Houston, it's always allergy season, right? You're always dealing with something. So again, get tested. You can get a flu test at your local provider, or you can go to any of our local testing sites and get tested for SARS-CoV-2. So again, it could be anyone, but the safest way is to know exactly what you're dealing with.
It really is interesting, because you see people now when they're out, or I've been out with people, they're like, oh, I have to cough. I'm going to run into the bathroom. Like, I don't want someone to kick me out of this place because I'm not quite sure why I'm sneezing at the moment.
We deal with it at work. We see people sometimes and they'll sneeze and everybody's kind of like holds their breath, like, did they really just sneeze? It's like, we do, for sure.
Is there such thing as a single test for flu and COVID-19? Or are those two separate tests?
They are two separate tests, even though the mechanism can be the same in terms of a nasal swab, but it is not the same test. So one is actually testing for SARS-CoV-2, and the other one is actually testing for influenza virus. So two different tests, same route, though.
As recently as a week ago, it's at least one, if not more than one, that are going through trials right now, but are not yet available on the market, that are dual tests for both influenza and for SARS-CoV-2. So we'll have to wait on that technology. Again, we've seen lots of evolution of test technologies and test types throughout 2020, and I suspect that will be the next evolution soon. It sounds like it's very, very close to the place where it will be more widely available in the open market.
Stay tuned.
Where is it that people can go for information about finding the test sites?
And I'm glad you asked, because we are really pushing for Houstonians to take advantage of these resources. We've really built a very sophisticated infrastructure of both fixed and mobile testing sites. And so I would say, A, you can go to one of two websites, HoustonEmergency.org, Houston Emergency being one word, .org. Or HoustonHealth.org, Houston Health also being one word. And we, again, ensure that we have daily updates about what's available on those websites. And then we have a COVID-19 specific hotline number I would encourage everyone to use. It is 832-393 4220, and you could just call and ask for a testing location either near you, or we certainly can give you granular information about what type of test each location is offering. So if people have a preference around what they would like to have and see. So those websites and that hotline number, I think, are the most efficient ways in which people can get up-to-date information.
Okay, 832-393-4220 is the phone number. And HoustonHealth.org, that's easy to remember.
That's right.
For months and months, I've been tracking. I read papers a lot, and I've been getting my Chronicle in the front yard each day. And for a while, there was a full page, color, graphics, the whole state, every county, color-coded, lots of charts and things like that. Sifting through all of that's kind of confusing for regular lay people. One of the things that I'd been tracking, and I remember Dr. Fauci saying this, is that by the time the winter comes, we want to be like at a positivity test rate of under 5% so that we are good. And that's the one I dove into, and I've been tracking this from back when it was up around 28, almost 30%. It got down under 10. It even got close to 6. And now it's, you know, gone back up a little bit. It never really got below 5. Is that really one of the best simple things to track, is what's the positivity response to all the testing? Or should I be looking at some other statistic to feel what I know?
There are lots of statistics to look at, but I would certainly say, and are trying to make sure the public is able to, you know, discern what is meant by all of those tables and graphs and statistics and numbers. It really is as simple as the positivity rate, if you want to use one indicator. In public health, we're monitoring a couple of 100 indicators, but for the general public, positivity rate. I mean, you may have heard things like, you know, 14-day rolling average, 7-day rolling average, or really trying to, we look at that data in a way to try to monitor trends. And we certainly look at the data to try to monitor which communities or individuals or pockets of individuals are being most impacted. So there are very simple measures. And overall, you know, our mayor, Sylvester Turner, has certainly wanted to press upon the general public, we're monitoring positivity rate, to give him guidance about how well we're doing as a jurisdiction, as a city. You know, he's called for our goal of being under 5%, and we achieved that for a very short period of time. And now, of course, we're creeping back up again. And I think Decrecia can add more. I hope I don't get fired. But I really do want to impress that it's not a political response to this disease. The methods, the tactics, the strategies that we're encouraging individuals and communities to do are very simple, easily implementable strategies. And if we all did our part, as you started this conversation with, we would be better together. We get better and we stay better when we all jointly decide these are the strategies we're going to take because we love Houston and we want to protect our community. So I would just say that, yes, look at the data. There's lots of data that we put up there for many different purposes, and we all use the data for specific ways. But if individuals want to know, you know, how am I individually impacted? What's going on with the trends in our city? That's one indicator that I think is simple to follow.
Okay, thanks.
So 1 to 100, we're doing our best just to keep up with the data.
I'll track that one and let you tell me about the others.
Got it. Decrecia, can you speak to us about like vaccines, what they are and why they even matter, and are flu shots for everyone, or is that just for some people?
Certainly. So I'm sure as you have watched the news and even read your paper, you've heard about many vaccine candidates that we have that are coming down the pipe. So vaccines really are a safe and effective tool that we have in public health to help decrease disease transmission in our communities. So there are many vaccines that are available on the market. Our most individuals associate vaccines with children, but vaccines really are things that should happen throughout the lifespan. So at at every age, at every stage, individuals are indicated for some kind of a vaccine. Flu vaccine is one of those vaccines that is an annual recommendation. So anyone greater than 6 months of age for which it is not contraindicated, and those individuals would primarily are individuals that may have an egg allergy or something along those lines. But anyone that's 6 months or greater should be checking with their provider and getting a flu vaccine annually. There are a few individuals that we target much more heavily. We actually want to have a high uptake of flu vaccine in our community, but specifically pregnant women and individuals 65 years of age and older, because we know that they tend to bear the brunt of the disease when it comes to adverse outcomes. So again, we just want to make sure that everybody is getting their annual flu vaccine, again, back to what's preventable. When a COVID-19 vaccine is available, when a safe and effective vaccine is on the market, public health will again play its part in terms of serving as a safety net for individuals who that vaccine is indicated. One thing that we do know is that it will be a phased approach. So once the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices comes out with those recommendations for who will be indicated in that initial phase, we certainly will be working with our community partners, our community stakeholders, most likely healthcare workers who have direct access and direct interaction with individuals who may have COVID-19 will most likely be in that first phase. So we'll be ensuring that we are enrolling providers, our healthcare community, so that they can vaccinate their healthcare workers. So again, it will be a phased approach. It won't be all the responsibility of the public health system. Everyone has a role to play. Public health certainly will stand up and play their role, but we are absolutely calling on everyone in the community, all providers, to go and sign up to become a COVID-19 provider, starting with our healthcare providers in our medical community, because they will be the individuals who will be one of the first indicated for the vaccine.
So the notion of warp speed, or the notion of things coming out that might make communities of color who have had historically complicated relationship with health and government, that level of precaution, in your opinion, may be minimized or be sort of a safety net that people can find comfort, that this is not days of old around public health for African-American communities in particular.
So Stephanie, we are very aware, and we are being very intentional in terms of our marketing and our partners around education and information for COVID-19. We understand that there is just certain apprehension that comes with the novelty of the vaccine. We have opinions about the name Operation Warp Speed, but what we do know is that in the health arena, one of the things that we have not and will not cut corners on is the safety and the effectiveness of the vaccine. What we do know is that the exact same phases and trials and requirements that any vaccine that is either licensed or that comes out as an emergency use authorization is the exact same requirements that this vaccine is having to undergo. I think what has caused probably some apprehension is just that, again, the novelty of it, and we don't hear about vaccine manufacturing in the way that we have seen with this vaccine because of the stage that COVID-19 is on. So this is something that we do, and I think for our African-American community, we do have, you know, the history of distrust and mistrust with the medical community, which is why it's even more important that in our messaging and in our education and engaging our community partners, that we be as transparent as we possibly can, that we actually over communicate, that we provide opportunities and listening sessions in communities of color so that we have the opportunity to hear what some of those apprehensions are. So again, it's really about getting into the community, hearing what some of the concerns are, being able to provide that information and education, and allowing individuals to make the decision that is best for them and their families. So we believe, and we stand with science, we believe it's that if we provide the right information, the correct information, individuals will make the right decision.
That's wonderful. I like science too.
Big fan of science.
We stand with science. We stand with science. Yep.
Yes.
As we begin to come to the end of this hour, we have a lot of unanswered questions about all the myriad other programs that the health department offers. We haven't even touched on dealing with mosquitoes, just to pick one of a whole number of things, mental health services,
right.
Addiction and alcoholism, right. And things related to the health in places like the jails, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. you know, things like that. So I don't know that we have time for all this, but I am curious for both of you who've been on the front lines since before the beginning, not only on this, but just in your careers and service. Mm-hmm. What is it in these current times, right now, right here, that gives you hope, that keeps you motivated, that inspires you to keep doing what it is you do?
Go ahead, DeCreasy. Oh, no, I was going to say, I think the one thing that gives me hope and keeps me motivated is really seeing us as a community galvanize around the idea that we can be better together. It gives me hope to know and to be able to provide information. And even in a us versus them kind of, culture or the current feel of the world. One thing that gives me hope is that in public health and in Houston, I believe that we are built when we think about us versus them. For us, the us for me is really us versus them, which is anything that threatens the public health of the citizens of Houston. So it's us against viruses. It's us against sexually transmitted diseases. It's us against mental health, anything that comes against your mental health. So it's not person to person. It's really us against, again, anything that stands to threaten the health and safety of any of the Houstonians. So I'm hopeful because I think even in this pandemic, we have seen that the human nature is really one that will cause us to really reach out, help a neighbor, reach out, help a coworker, and really figure out how do we outsmart the virus and limit the opportunities for disease spread and increase the opportunity for the spread of love and community, even in a socially distant way. So even though we have to socially distance, we don't have to be emotionally distant. So that's mm-hmm. what gives me hope.
Mm-hmm. Marlene?
I really can't top that. All I wanted to that was absolutely perfect. And I just say, you know, young people give me hope. Houstonians give me hope. Mm-hmm. What I've seen throughout 2020 and people, you know, mobilizing and, you know, galvanizing, as the word Decrecia used, together, it's been phenomenal to watch. It just warms my soul and my spirit. And I just wanted to close by really talking through the real passion and mission of health department employees. I think what most residents of Houston may not be aware of is how diverse of a group and team that we are. We come from so many cultures and backgrounds and experiences. And so when people think of, you know, the health department, they may think of the government and the city, and that, you know, we're not a bunch of group of, you know, old men sitting in ivory towers. We really are a diverse team that come from communities in which we're trying to serve. And so we really do have opportunities ahead of us to make change. And I've personally seen this group of people working in communities, making changes my entire career. So that's what pushes me to move on. And I know even with this pandemic, so much we don't know how to effectively address it. I know we're going to find out. I know we're going to win. And I know we're going to get there.
I love that form of positivity. I like when that percentage is high. That's
good. That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah. And again, the phone number is 832-393-4220. Easy website, houstonhealth.org. Marlene McNeese, Decrecia Limbrick, thank you so much for spending this time with us on The Open Journal. It's mm-hmm. been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for the opportunity. Yes.
Well, dear friends, it is time to wrap this edition of Open Journal. I'm Dwayne Bradley. Check kpft.org for the program archive. Subscribe to our podcast, KPFTOJ. We're open to your feedback, suggestions, and ideas. And thanks for tuning in and joining us. And thanks for supporting us.
Yes, I'm Stephanie Coleman. I'm so glad to be here with you again in this community conversation. As always, we are a dedicated all-volunteer production staff, including Rambling Rick Campbell, Susan Phillips, Maverick, and supporters, you. Thank you so much. Open Journal theme music provided by Kevin McLeod. And be here with us for Open Journal next time for more great conversations. Thanks for your donations. Thanks for listening. And thanks for your support.
And as always, we like to leave you with a thought to carry you through the week. This comes to us from Abraham Lincoln, who said, "My dream is of a place and a time where America will once again be seen as the last best hope of Earth." Take care of each other.